isn't it?
Cimmerine nodded. There was a whole page about somebody finding a stone in the caves so that the dragons could pick a king. It didn't make much sense to me.
Cullen Stone. We've used it to choose our king ever since the first time. When a king dies, all the dragons go to the Ford of Whispering Snakes in the Enchanted Forest and take turns trying to move Cullen Stone from there to the Vanishing Mountain. The one that succeeds is the next king.
What if there are two dragons strong enough to move it?
It's not a matter of strength. Cullen Stone isn't much larger than you are. Even a small dragon could carry that much weight twice around the Enchanted Forest without any trouble at all. But Cullen Stone has an aura, a kind of vibration. When you carry it, you can feel it humming through your claws, and the humming gets stronger the farther you go until your bones are shaking. Most dragons have to drop it or be shaken to pieces, but there's always one who is suited to the stone. For that dragon, the stone's humming is just a pleasant buzz, so of course it's easy to get it to the Vanishing Mountain.
You sound as if you've had experience.
Of course. I was old enough to participate in the tests when the last king died.
She smiled reminiscently.
I got farther than anyone expected me to, though I wasn't one of the top 10 by any means.
Cimmerine tilted her head to one side, considering. I think I'm glad you didn't win.
Oh? Why is that?
Because you wouldn't have had any use for a princess if you were the queen of the dragons. And if you hadn't decided to take me on, that yellow-green dragon Morans would probably have eaten me, Cimmerine explained.
You mean, if I were the king of the dragons? Queen of the dragons is a dull job.
But you're a female. If you'd carried Cullen Stone from the Ford of Whispering Snakes to the Vanishing Mountain, you'd have had to be a queen, wouldn't you?
No, of course not. Queen of the dragons is a totally different job from king. And it's not one I'm particularly interested in. Most people aren't. I think the position's been vacant since Aurum tore his wing and had to retire.
But King Tokoz is a male dragon, isn't he?
Yes. Yes, but that has nothing to do with it. King is the name of the job. It doesn't matter who holds it.
Cimmerine stopped and thought for a moment. You mean that dragons don't care whether their king is male or female? The title is the same no matter who the ruler is.
That's right. We like to keep things simple.
Oh. Cimmerine decided to return to the original topic of conversation before the dragon's simple ideas confused her any further. Why would the wizards be interested in Cullen Stone if it's only used for picking out the kings of the dragons?
I doubt that they are. However, Cullen's Stone was found in the Caves of Fire and Night. And wizards have always been interested in the caves. But the dragons control most of them, and all the easy entrances are ours. So the wizards have never been able to find out as much as they would like. The Historia Dracorum is one of the few books that talks about the caves at all, and there aren't many copies. I'll wager Zeminar would have stolen it outright if he'd thought he could get away with it.
I thought the dragons let wizards into the Caves of Fire and Night. Why would Zeminar be poking through history books looking for information if he can just go and look at them whenever he wants to?
We don't let wizards visit the caves whenever they want. If we did, they'd be running in and out all the time. And nobody would be able to breathe without sneezing. No, they're limited to certain days and times. And if they want to visit the Caves of Fire and Night otherwise, they have to use one of the entrances we don't control. Few of them try. The other ways of getting into the caves are very dangerous, even for wizards.
Maybe they're looking for an easier way in.
Hmm.
Gazul did not seem to be paying much attention. She thought for a moment, then turned toward the cave mouth.
I'm going to see Gaurim. Roxham said a book had been stolen from her library, and I want to know which one. I'll be back in a few hours.
I think I'll go look at the Historia Dracorum again while you're gone. If there is something useful in it about the Caves of Fire and Night, maybe I can find it now that I know what I'm looking for. Cimmerine spent the rest of the afternoon carefully translating the chapter that talked about the caves. She was disappointed to find that there was very little about the caves themselves, though what was there was interesting. The book told how the dragons had discovered the back way into the caves and described some of the things they had found in them. Caverns full of blue and green fire, pools of black liquid that would cast a cloud of darkness for 20 miles around if you poured 3 drops on the ground. Walls made of crystals that multiplied every sound 1,000-fold. Rocks that spurted fire when they were broken. Most of the rest of the chapter was about Colin's stone, and how it was taken out of the caves by the first king of the dragons. K'Zul returned just before dinner, and she and Cimmerine compared notes. Cimmerine told K'Zul what she had learned from the chapter on the caves of fire and night, and then K'Zul explained what she had learned from Gaurim.
The stolen book was the Kings of the Dragons, and the entire first section was about Colin's stone and the caves of fire and night. And only a wizard could have gotten past the spells and safeguards Gaurim puts on her library. I think that settles it. The wizards are definitely collecting information about the caves of fire and night.
Then why do they keep looking at books of dragon history? It seems like a roundabout way of finding out whatever it is that they want to know.
There isn't any other way to do it. Nobody but dragons has ever had much to do with the caves, and no one has written much about them except in dragon histories. Even the wizards weren't particularly interested in them until a few years ago, except as a reliable route into the Enchanted Forest.
But from what I've been reading in the Historia Dracorum, the caves sound fascinating. You mean to say that no one has ever written anything about the Caves of Fire and Night except dragons?
That's...
K'Zul stopped suddenly, and her eyes narrowed.
No, that's not right. There was a rather rumpled scholar who talked his way into the caves a century or so back. And after he left, he wrote an extremely dry book about what he found there. I'd forgotten about him.
Do you have a copy?
No. But I don't think the Society of Wizards does either. There weren't very many of them printed, and a lot of those were lost in a flood a few years later. Some hero or other shoved a giant into a lake to drown him. The silly clunch didn't realize that if he put something that big into a lake, the water would have to go somewhere.
Well, that doesn't do us much good. It's nice that the Society of Wizards doesn't have a copy of that book. But if we can't get hold of one either...
I didn't say that. I don't have a copy myself, but I know who does.
Who?
Morwen. I'm afraid you're not going to be able to work on that fireproofing spell of yours tomorrow. We're going to take a trip to the Enchanted Forest instead.
7. In which Cimmerine and K'Zul make a journey underground. Cimmerine was surprised to hear that K'Zul intended to take her along on the visit to Morwen, and she was not entirely sure she liked the idea. She had heard a great deal about the Enchanted Forest, and none of it was reassuring. People who traveled there were always getting changed into flowers or trees or animals or rocks, or doing something careless and having their heads turned backward, or being carried off by ogres or giants or trolls, or enchanted by witches or wicked fairies. It did not sound like a good place for a casual, pleasant visit. On the other hand, it seemed unlikely that anything dreadful would happen to Cimmerine if she were traveling with a dragon, and she was looking forward to seeing Morwen again. Besides, Cimmerine was curious.
And anyway,
she said to herself,
K'Zul says I'm going, and there's no point in worrying about it if I don't have any choice.
Nevertheless, she decided to take one of the smaller magic swords along with her, if K'Zul said it was all right. Cimmerine saw no point in taking unnecessary chances. K'Zul had no objection, so Cimmerine picked out a small, plain-looking sword in a worn leather scabbard that made the wearer invincible, and they started off. Cimmerine had assumed that K'Zul would fly through the pass, but K'Zul said no.
It's not that easy to get into the Enchanted Forest, at least not if you're trying to get in. Princes and youngest sons, and particularly clever tailors, stumble into it by accident all the time. But if one wants to go there on purpose, one has to follow the proper route.
I didn't think dragons had that kind of problem.
Dragons don't, but you're not a dragon.
So instead of flying through the Pass of Silver Ice, K'Zul led Cimmerine through the tunnels. Cimmerine had to walk very quickly to keep up, even though Kazul was moving slowly. It was not long before she was wishing that the tunnels were high enough for her to ride on Kazul's back. The route twisted around and up and back and forth and down and around again until Cimmerine was thoroughly lost. Finally, they came to a gate made of iron bars that completely blocked the passage. Cimmerine studied it carefully, but she could see no sign of a handle or a lock.
This is the entrance to the Caves of Fire and Night. Be careful from here on, and don't wander away, or you'll get lost.
Cimmerine refrained from saying that as far as she was concerned, they were lost already.
How are you going to open it?
She asked instead.
Like this. By night and flame and shining rock, open thou thy hidden lock, Alberolingon.
As the sound of Kazul's voice died away, the iron gate swung silently open.
That's a very unusual opening spell.
It wasn't always that complicated,
Kazul said. She sounded almost apologetic.
I believe the first version was very simple. Just open sesame. But word got around and we had to change it.
Cimmerine nodded and followed Kazul through the gate and into the Caves of Fire and Night. For the first 100 yards or so, the only difference Cimmerine could see between these caves and the ordinary tunnels on the other side of the gate was that the Caves of Fire and Night were warmer. Then, very suddenly, her lamp went out, plunging everything into complete and utter blackness. Cimmerine stopped walking immediately.
Kazul?
It's quite all right, Princess,
Kazul's disembodied voice said from out of the darkness.
This happens all the time here. Don't bother trying to relight the lamp. Just put your hand on my elbow and follow along that way.
All right,
Cimmerine said doubtfully. She groped with her free hand in the direction of Kazul's voice and scraped her knuckles on the dragon's scales.
Ow!
Take your time.
I'm ready,
Cimmerine said. Her right hand was pressed flat against the cool, rough-edged scales at the back of Kazul's left forearm.
Just don't move too fast, or I'll lose you or get stepped on or something.
Kazul did her best to oblige, but Cimmerine still had difficulty in keeping up. She had to take at least 3 steps for every one of Kazul's, and it seemed that every time she moved her foot, she hit a rock or an uneven place in the tunnel floor. Then she would stumble, and her hand would scrape and slide against Kazul's scales, so that she was afraid she would lose contact with the dragon.
Are you sure I shouldn't try and relight the lamp?
Cimmerine asked, after her 5th painful stumble and slide.
Quite sure. You see, it isn't... Ah, there it goes.
While Kazul was speaking, there was a flicker of light, and then the darkness rolled aside like a curtain being pulled. Cimmerine found herself standing in a large cave, whose walls glittered as if they were studded with thousands of tiny mirrors. The lamp in her left hand was burning cheerfully once more.
Was it the lamp?
Cimmerine asked, after studying it for a moment.
Or was it me?
It was the caves. That was one of the reasons they're of night as well as of fire.
Only one of the reasons? I don't like the sound of that.
You'll be quite all right as long as you're with me. Very few things are willing to mess with a dragon, even in the dark. And the periods of darkness don't last long. It's because the magic of these caves doesn't affect us as much as other people. Or so I'm told.
You mean that blackness is likely to come back?
Kazul nodded.
Then let's get as far as we can before it does,
Cimmerine said, and started across the cave. There were 4 tunnels leading out of the opposite side of the glittering cavern. Kazul took the 2nd from the left without hesitating an instant.
Where do all these tunnels go?
Cimmerine asked, glancing at the other 3 openings as she followed Kazul.
The one on the right end leads to a chain of caverns,
Kazul said over her shoulder.
The first few are quite ordinary, but then you come to one full of hot sulfur pools. Some of the older dragons bathe there. They claim the water is good for rheumatism. Beyond that is a cave with molten silver dripping down the walls, and the chain ends at a deep chasm with a river of red-hot melted rock at the bottom.
Doesn't sound very attractive.
The dwarf smiths find it very useful for forging magic swords. The 2nd tunnel on the right takes you into a maze. The tunnels and caverns constantly shift around, so that no matter how carefully you mark your way, you always get lost.
Even dragons?
Kazul nodded.
Though I believe there was one prince who managed to find his way out with a magic ball of string.
Oh, bother,
said Cimmerian. The lights had gone out again, just as they emerged into a small cave.
It's quite all right. This part's easy.
Next time I'm going to bring a cane. Where do the other tunnels lead?
The one on the far left goes through a couple of caverns that are pretty, but not very interesting. We're always chasing knights and princes out of it, though. They come for flasks of water from a bottomless pool at the far end.
What does it do?
Ow! She had just banged her right elbow against the wall of the cave in the dark.
It casts a cloud of darkness for 20 miles around when it's poured on the ground.
How useful,
Cimmerine muttered balefully, rubbing her elbow.
And this tunnel leads to the Enchanted Forest, by way of the King's Cave,
Kazul finished.
Oh, good. I was hoping to see that.
The King's Cave was the chamber where the first King of the Dragons had found Colin's stone, and the Historia Dracorum had not described it anywhere near well enough to suit Cimmerian.
And here's the light coming back, thank goodness. Let's hurry before it goes again.
They went through 3 small caves and 2 more periods of blackness before they reached the King's Cave. Kazul pointed out various locations of interest, such as the wall of crystal with a chip in one corner, where the Prince of the Ruby Throne had stolen a piece to make a magic ring, and the jewel-studded cavern where the King of the Dragons met with people who needed impressing. There was one very eerie cave full of slabs of black rock. Most were standing on end, though a few had fallen over. Kazul said they were all enchanted princes.
All of them?
There were at least 40 of the stone slabs, and the cave was quite crowded. Kazul shook her head.
No, the one on the end there is just an ordinary boulder.
How did it happen?
The princes came to steal some of the water of healing from the well at the end of the cave. There are 2 dippers by the well. One is tin, the other is solid gold and covered with jewels. The princes all tried to use the gold one, even though they'd been told that only the tin dipper would work. It's no more than they deserve.
Cimmerian frowned, thinking of some of the princes she had known.
Well, I won't deny that they probably behaved foolishly, but...
Foolishly?
Kazul snorted.
Any reasonably well-educated prince ought to have sense enough to follow directions when he's on a quest. But all of these fellows were sure they knew better. If they'd simply done what they were told, they wouldn't be here.
Still, turning them into slabs of stone forever seems a little extreme.
Oh, they won't be stone forever. Sooner or later, someone will come along who has the sense not to improvise, and he'll succeed in getting the water. Then he'll use some of it to disenchant this lot, and the cave will be empty for a while until the next batch of young idiots starts arriving.
Cimmerian felt better knowing that the princess would someday be freed, though she had sense enough not to try doing it herself. Since she had not been sent on a quest for the water of healing, it was highly unlikely that she would be able to disenchant the princes, even if she succeeded in taking the water. And she knew enough about quests and enchantments and the obtaining of things with magical properties to know that she would probably get into a lot of trouble if she tried. So she tucked the matter into the back of her mind and followed Kazul through the stone-filled cavern. She was careful not to step on any of the fallen slabs. Just outside the entrance to the next cave, Kazul stopped.
This is the King's Cave. We have to cross it as quickly as we can. Don't stop in the middle, and don't say anything while we're inside. Understand? Good. Come on, then.
As soon as she stepped inside the cave, Cimmerian understood the reason for Kazul's request for silence. The walls, the ceiling, and the floor were made of dark, shiny stone that multiplied and threw back echoes of even the smallest sound. The soft scraping of Kazul's scales against the floor sounded like 30 men sawing wood, and the tiny gasp Cimmerian gave at the sight and sound of the cave was as loud as if she had shouted. Cimmerian went on as quietly and carefully as she could. Halfway across, she noticed the vibration. It began as a gentle and not unpleasant buzzing in her bones, unrelated to the loud and continually multiplying echoes of her passage, though it, too, grew stronger the farther into the cave she went. K'Zul was in front of her now, and she saw the dragon's tail lash once, as if in pain or anger. Suddenly, she remembered K'Zul's description of the aura that made it impossible for most dragons to carry Colin's stone, and that this was the place where Colin's stone had been found. No wonder K'Zul was uncomfortable. Cimmerine found herself wishing she could stop and pay attention to the humming in her bones, but she remembered K'Zul's directions and continued walking. She had nearly reached the exit when she saw a pebble about the size of her thumbnail, made of the same dark, shiny stone as the cavern walls. K'Zul had said nothing about picking things up, so Cimmerine veered a little to the right and scooped the pebble up as she passed. A moment later, she was out of the cave.
Ugh, I'm glad that's over. From here on, it should be easy.
Good,
said Cimmerine. She dropped the pebble into her pocket to look at more closely later, and followed K'Zul down the narrow, winding tunnel. 8. In which Cimmerine and K'Zul pay a call, and Cimmerine gets into a fight. A few minutes later, they came out of the caves of fire and night into bright sunlight. Cimmerine had to shade her eyes against the sudden glare. As her eyes adjusted, she saw a large clearing around the mouth of the cave. The ground was covered with short grass, so lush and dense that it made Cimmerine think of green fur. Here and there a tiny flower twinkled among the blades of grass. At the edge of the clearing, the forest began, but Cimmerine could only make out the first row of trees. They were enormous, so large that they dwarfed even K'Zul.
Leave the lamp here. There's no sense in carting it around the forest when we won't need it until we come back.
Cimmerine set the lamp on the ground just inside the mouth of the cave.
Now what?
Now we go to Morwen's, and we'll get there more quickly if you ride. If you climb up on that rock over there, you ought to be able to get on my back without too much trouble.
Are you sure you don't mind?
Cimmerine said, scrambling up onto the rock K'Zul had indicated.
I wouldn't have suggested it if I minded. Right there will be fine. You can hang onto the spike in front of you, and you won't foul my wings if I have to take off suddenly.
Cimmerine did not like the implication that there were things in the enchanted forest that were nasty enough to make a dragon want to take off suddenly, but she did not say so. It was too late to back out, and she certainly wasn't going to wait at the mouth of the cave all alone while K'Zul went off to visit Morwen. There was no reason to think that waiting would be any safer than going along. As soon as Cimmerine was settled, K'Zul set off into the forest at a rapid pace. At first, Cimmerine had to concentrate on holding on, but after a while she began to get the hang of it. Soon she was able to look at some of the things they were passing. The trees were huge. Cimmerine guessed that even if there were four of her, holding hands, she would not be able to reach all the way around one of the trunks. The ground was carpeted with bright green moss that looked even thicker than the grass in the clearing. Cimmerine saw no flowers in it, but she spotted several bushes and a vine with three different colors of fruit. K'Zul changed course several times for no reason that Cimmerine could see, but she did not like to distract the dragon by asking questions. They passed a mansion guarded by a fence made of gold and a short tower without any windows or doors. Then K'Zul splashed through a shallow stream and made a sharp turn. The trees thinned a little, and K'Zul stopped in front of a neat gray house with a wide porch and a red roof. Over the door was a black and gold sign in large block letters reading, "None of this nonsense, please." There were several cats of various sizes and colors perched on the porch railing or lying in the sun. As Cimmerine dismounted, K'Zul said to one of them,
"Would you be good enough to tell Morwen that I'm here, and would like to talk to her?"
The cat, a large gray tom, blinked its yellow eyes at K'Zul. Then he jumped down from the porch rail and sauntered into the house, his tail held high as if to say, "I'm doing this as a particular favor, mind," And don't you forget it.
He doesn't seem very impressed.
Why should he be?
Well, you're a dragon,
Cimmerine answered, a little taken aback.
What difference does that make to a cat?
Fortunately, Cimmerine did not have to find an answer, for at that moment, Morwen appeared in the doorway. She was wearing the same black robe she had worn when she visited Cimmerine, or another one exactly like it, and she peered through her glasses with the air of someone studying an unexpected and rather peculiar puzzle.
Good morning, Kazool,
she said after a moment.
This is a surprise.
Good. If you aren't expecting us to be here, no one else is either.
That's the way of things, is it? How much of a hurry are you in?
Not much of one, as long as no one knows we're here.
Then Cimmerine had better get down and have something to drink. There's cider or goat's milk, though if you want that, you'll have the cats after you. Or I can put a kettle on for tea. Good gracious, what have you done to your hand?
While Morwen had been talking, Cimmerine had turned and slid carefully down Kazul's side. It was a long slide, and when her feet hit the ground, she had to put out a hand to keep from falling. Morwen's exclamation made her blink in surprise, and she looked down. The palm of her right hand was covered with blood, from half a dozen deep slashes and as many scrapes.
Oh, dear. It must have happened in the caves when it was so dark. I didn't realize. It doesn't hurt at all.
Hurting or not, it needs attention. Come inside, and I'll see to it while Kazool tells me why you're here. You'll have to go around back this time,
she added, turning to Kazool.
The front steps won't take the weight. A gnome stole one of the supports, and I haven't had time to get it fixed yet. Pesky creatures, they're worse than mice.
Don't the cats keep the mice away?
Cimmerine asked, mildly puzzled.
Yes, but they don't do a thing about gnomes, which is why gnomes are worse. Mind the step.
Kazool started walking while Morwen shooed Cimmerine up the wooden steps and into the house. Several of the cats eyed Cimmerine curiously as she passed, and a tortoiseshell kitten got up and followed her in. The front door led into a large, airy room with an iron stove in one corner. There was a good deal of furniture, but everything except the table and the stove had at least one cat on top of it. Morwen frowned at a fat and fluffy Persian that was sitting on one of the chairs. The cat stood up, yawned, gave its front paws a cursory lick or two, just to show that this was all his own idea, and jumped down onto the floor. As Cimmerine sat down in the vacated chair, there was a knock at the wooden door on the opposite side of the room.
That'll be Kazool,
Morwen said. She crossed to the door and opened it.
Come in. I'll get you some cider as soon as I've seen to Cimmerine's hand.
Morwen's back door did not seem to get any larger, and Kazool certainly did not get any smaller. But when she put her head through the doorway, her scales did not even scrape the sides. The rest of her followed with no apparent difficulty, and somehow there was plenty of room in the kitchen even after she got inside. Kazool settled down along the far wall, where she would be out of the way, and as soon as she stopped moving, six cats jumped onto various portions of her tail, back, and shoulders. Neither Kazool nor Morwen seemed to notice. Morwen took a small tin box from a shelf beside the stove and sat down at the table beside Cimmerine.
Now, tell me what you're here for,
she said, taking a roll of linen and two jars of ointment out of the box.
Apart from my cider, I mean.
Cimmerine had some interesting visitors yesterday.
If they were interesting, they can't have been knights.
They weren't. They were wizards. And they went to a lot of trouble to get a look at my copy of the Historia Dracorum, the part that describes the caves of fire and night.
And you think that's why they've been sniffing around the mountains of mourning for the past 6 months? How did you find out what they were looking at? Or did they ask permission?
I don't think Zeminar would ask permission for anything, even if he was sure he'd get it. He'd consider it beneath him. No, I saw him shut the book, and he was only a little further along from where I'd left my bookmark. Ow! That stings!
Good! It's supposed to!
She closed the jar of salve she had been smearing on Cimmerine's palm and began wrapping the injured hand in the linen bandage.
Did Zeminar get what he was after?
I don't think so. He said he wanted to come back for another visit, And I don't think he'd have done that if he'd found whatever he was looking for.
That seems like a reasonable assumption, though wizards aren't always reasonable. There, that should take care of things. Don't take the bandage off for at least 4 days, and if you're going to cook anything that has fennel in it, stir it left-handed.
Zeminar's interest in the Historia Dracorum isn't the only thing that points to his curiosity about the Caves of Fire and Night,
K'Zul said, and explained about the book that had been stolen.
There have been other incidents as well, and nearly all the wizards we've caught poking around have been somewhere in or near the caves. That's why no one thought much about it at first. Ever since King Tokaz made that agreement with the Society of Wizards, they've been claiming they're supposed to have more time in the caves than we're willing to give them. Everyone thought this was more of the same.
Not everyone,
Morwen said, giving K'Zul a sharp look.
I am widely considered to be unduly suspicious of everyone and everything, particularly wizards.
And what do your suspicions make of this business?
I think Zeminar is trying to find out something about the Caves of Fire and Night. Something he hasn't been able to learn from visiting the caves in person. Hence, his recent interest in histories that describe the caves, however briefly.
And you're hoping I have something in my library that will help you figure out what it is?
I don't hope. I know. Unless someone has run off with your copy of de Montmorency's A Journey Through the Caves of Fire and Night.
If someone has, he'll regret it. Wait here and I'll check.
She rose and went out. Through the doorway, Cimmerine could see a room full of tall, dark-stained shelves. Cimmerine blinked.
Isn't that the door you came in through?
She asked K'Zul. K'Zul nodded.
Of course.
I thought it led out into Morwen's yard.
It leads wherever Morwen wants it to lead.
I see,
said Cimmerine, wishing her father's court philosopher were there. He was very pompous and stuffy, particularly about magic, which he claimed was 90% trickery and the rest illusion. Cimmerine had found him very trying. Dealing with Morwen's door would probably have given him a headache. Morwen came back into the kitchen holding a thin red book.
Here it is. I'm sorry it took me so long to find it, but the nonfiction isn't organized as well as it should be yet.
K'Zul surged to her feet, shedding cats in all directions. The cats gave her reproachful looks and then stalked out the front door with affronted dignity. K'Zul paid no attention. She curled her head around to peer at the book over Morwen's shoulder.
I suppose you'll want to borrow it?
I certainly do. Is there a problem?
Only if it gets stolen. There are very few of these around, and I'm not sure I could replace it.
I'll keep it in the vault with the treasure. Zeminar won't think to look for it there, and even if he does, he won't get in. I've got enough anti-wizard spells on the door to stop the whole society. They can't get in unless someone invites them.
All right,
Morwen said, handing the book to K'Zul.
Is that everything you came for?
No,
said K'Zul. She looked at Morwen with limpid eyes and went on in a plaintive tone.
I still haven't had any cider.
Morwen laughed and went to one of the cupboards. She pulled out 2 mugs and a large mixing bowl and filled them with an amber-colored liquid she poured from a heavy-looking pottery jug. She set the mixing bowl in front of K'Zul and gave one of the mugs to Cimmerine, then sat down with the second mug herself. They were in Morwen's kitchen for over an hour, drinking cider and speculating about what the wizards were up to. After a while, several of the cats came back, and Morwen gave them a dish of goat's milk, which soothed their ruffled feelings somewhat.
How is that fireproofing spell of yours coming?
Morwen asked as she returned to the table.
I have everything I need except the powdered hen's teeth, and I'm beginning to think I'm never going to find any. K'Zul has offered to let me look through the jars in the treasury, but if there isn't any there, I don't know where I'll look next.
Really?
Morwen said, giving K'Zul a sharp look.
Well, if you can't find any hen's teeth, you could try substituting snake fingernails or the hair from a turtle's egg. I wouldn't try it except as a last resort, though. Altering spells is a very tricky business.
At last they had to leave. Kazool went out the same way she had come in, while Cimmerine watched in fascination. Then Cimmerine and Morwen went on to the front porch. Kazool sidled up to the house, and Cimmerine stood on the porch railing to climb onto her back. The cats were seriously affronted by this maneuver, and expressed their displeasure in reproachful glances and low yowls.
Oh, don't take any notice. It only encourages them.
Cimmerine nodded.
Thank you for everything.
You're quite welcome. Don't wait too long to come again.
You'd better take this, princess,
Kazool said, reaching back over her shoulder to hand Morwen's book to Cimmerine.
I can't carry it and run at the same time.
Cimmerine took the book and tucked it into her pocket.
I'm all set,
she said, and they started off. Cimmerine enjoyed the ride back to the Mountains of Morning. She was now sufficiently accustomed to riding on a dragon to be able to concentrate on looking at the forest as it flashed past. The trees seemed almost identical to one another, but Cimmerine spotted quite a few odd-looking bushes and vines, and twice she thought she saw small faces staring out at her from among leafy branches. They reached the threshold of the caves much sooner than Cimmerine expected. Kazool waited while she slid to the ground, then said,
The entrance is a little narrow. I'll go first and make sure there's nothing unpleasant waiting for us.
Cimmerine nodded, and Kazool vanished into the cave. Before Cimmerine could follow, she heard a shrill cry above her. She looked up and saw an enormous white bird plummeting toward her, its clawed feet extended to attack. For an instant, Cimmerine was frozen by surprise and fear. Then she ducked and reached for her sword. She was almost too slow. The bird was on top of her, shrieking and slashing, before she had done more than grasp the hilt of her weapon. But the sword seemed to leap out of the scabbard as soon as she touched it, and she swung clumsily as she rolled aside. She did not expect to do any damage, just to force the bird to back away a little, but she felt the sword connect and heard a wail of pain from the bird. Thanking all her lucky stars individually and by name, Cimmerine twisted and scrambled to her feet, sword ready. There was nothing for her to guard against. The sword stroke had been more effective than she realized. The bird was dying. As she stared at it, it raised its head.
You killed me! But you're a maiden!
Actually, she's a princess.
Kazool's voice said from behind Cimmerine.
My princess! So you'd have been in even bigger trouble if you'd succeeded in carrying her off.
I don't think I could have done it if I hadn't had a magic sword,
said Cimmerine, who was beginning to wish she hadn't. She had never hurt anyone before, and she didn't like it.
Just my luck! Oh, well, fair's fair. You killed me, so you get my forfeit.
You're not dead yet. If you let me near, I can try to stop the bleeding.
Not a chance,
the bird said. It was beginning to sound rather faint.
Do you want the forfeit or don't you?
Take it,
Kazool advised. Cimmerine said nothing, and after a moment the bird said,
All right, then. Under my left wing, you'll find 3 black feathers. If you drop one and wish to be somewhere else, you'll find yourself there in the twinkling of an eye. Any questions?
Can I take anyone else with me?
Cimmerine asked, thinking that if the bird was so determined to give her the feathers, she might as well cooperate with it. The bird looked at her with respect.
Will wonders never cease? For once a human with sense is getting the forfeit. Yes, you can take someone with you, as long as you're touching him. Same for objects. If you can carry it, you can take it with you. You get 1 trip per feather. That's all.
But,
said Cimmerine, and stopped. The bird's head had fallen back, and it was clearly quite dead.
Don't feel too bad. If it had succeeded in carrying you off, it would have fed you to its nestlings.
Fed me to its nestlings?
Cimmerine discovered that she had lost her sympathy for the dead bird.
What a horrid thing to do!
Won't the nestlings starve now that the bird is dead?
No. One of the other birds will take over the chore of feeding them for a few weeks until they're big enough to catch their own food. Now, clean that sword and take your feathers, and let's get going. I want to have a look at that Book of Morwen's.
Cimmerine nodded and did as she was told. The three black feathers were right where the bird had said they would be, and she put them in her pocket with Morwen's book and the black pebble from the Caves of Fire and Night. She wiped the sword on the grass several times, then finished cleaning it with her handkerchief. When she finished, she left the handkerchief beside the dead bird and followed K'Zul into the Caves of Fire and Night. Nine, in which Therindil is a dreadful nuisance and Cimmerine casts a spell. The rest of the trip home was uneventful. Passing through the king's cave seemed easier going in the opposite direction, and the impenetrable darkness only descended once. As soon as they arrived, K'Zul took the book Morwen had lent them and curled herself around a rock just outside the mouth of the cave to study it while Cimmerine made dinner. She pored over the book all evening, and Cimmerine found it fascinating to watch the dragon delicately turning pages with her claws. Early the next day, K'Zul went off to consult with Roxham. Cimmerine was rather stiff from all the dragon riding she had done the previous day, so she decided not to do any more cleaning. Instead, she spent the morning in K'Zul's treasure room, sorting through likely-looking bottles and jars for those that might possibly contain powdered hen's teeth. Remembering K'Zul's advice, she started by setting aside all the bottles she could find that had lead stoppers. Since the light was not very good, she took the jars and bottles that looked as if they might be worth investigating and piled them in her apron so as to carry them outside more easily. She had nearly finished sorting when she heard a voice calling faintly in the distance.
"Bother," she said. "I did hope they'd leave me alone a little longer."
She bundled the last 5 bottles into her apron without looking at them and, not forgetting to lock the door behind her, hurried out through the maze to see who was shouting for her this time. It was Therindil.
"What are you doing here? I told you I wasn't going to be ready to be rescued for at least a month."
"I was worried. I heard that you'd broken a leg, but you look fine to me."
"Of course I haven't broken a leg. Where did you get that idea?"
"Some knight at the inn at the foot of the mountain. He was up yesterday talking to the princess he's trying to rescue, and he came back and warned everybody not to bother with the princess that was captured by the dragon K'Zul. Well, I knew that was you, so I asked why, and he said his princess told him you'd broken your leg and wouldn't be able to walk for months."
Cimmerine smiled slightly. Alianora had apparently gone through with her plan to tell Halana about Cimmerine's twisted ankle, and Halana had decided to improve the story a little in hopes of reducing the competition.
"Somebody must have gotten mixed up. You can stop worrying. I'm fine. Is that all you came for? These jars are getting heavy, and I've got work to do."
"Cimmerine, we have to talk."
"Then we'll have to do it while I work."
She turned on her heel and marched into the kitchen, full of annoyance. She had been feeling almost friendly toward Therindil. He had been worried about her, after all. Until he said he wanted to talk. Cimmerine was quite sure that what he wanted to talk about was rescuing her, and she was annoyed with him for being so stupidly stubborn, and annoyed with herself for being annoyed when he was only trying to do the best he could. Therindil followed her into the kitchen.
"What is all that?"
he asked as Cimmerine put the apron full of jars on the kitchen table and began lining them up.
"Some things I'm checking for K'Zul."
She picked up a small jar made of carved jade and pried the lid off. It was half full of green salve. Cimmerine put the lid back on and set the jar aside.
"What was it you wanted to talk about?"
she asked, reaching for another jar.
"You. Dragons. Us. That looks interesting. Can I help?"
"As long as you don't break anything. Some of these are very fragile."
Maybe opening jars would make him forget about you. Dragons. Us, for a while.
"I'll be very careful. This one looks like metal. I'll start with that, shall I?"
He picked up one of the larger jars, made of beaten copper with two handles. He frowned at the top, then reached for his dagger, and as he tilted the jar, Cimmerine saw that the neck was stopped up with lead.
"Not that one," she said quickly.
She didn't remember picking out that particular jar. It must have been one of the last four or five that she'd scooped up when she heard Therindil calling.
"Why not? I said I'd be careful."
The tip of his dagger was already embedded in the lead.
"Kazul said to leave the ones with lead stoppers alone, so put it back."
"If you insist,"
Therindil said, shrugging. He pulled on his dagger, but it was stuck fast in the lead.
"Drat,"
he said, and twisted the handle. The dagger came free, and the lead stopper came along with it.
"I should have known."
A black cloud of smoke poured out of the jar. As Cimmerine and Therindil watched, it condensed into a dark-skinned giant wearing only a turban and a loincloth. He was more than twice as tall as Therindil, and the corners of his mouth were turned down in a stern frown.
"What is it?"
"Trouble."
"Thou speakest truly, O daughter of wisdom,"
said the giant in a booming voice that filled the cave.
"For I am a djinn who was imprisoned in that jar, and I am the instrument of thy death and that of thy paramour."
"My what?"
"Thy lover. The man who stands beside thee."
"I know what you meant, but he isn't my lover, or my fiancé, or my boyfriend, or anything, and I refuse to be killed with him."
"But, Cimmerine, you know perfectly well—"
"You hush! You've made enough of a mess already."
"If he is not thy paramour, nor any of those other things, then what is he?"
"A nuisance."
"Cimmerine, you're not being very kind."
"What he is matters not,"
the djinn said grandly after a moment's heavy thought.
"It is enough that thou and he shall die."
"Enough for whom?"
The djinn blinked at her.
"For me. 'Tis my will that thou and he shall die by my hand. Thou hast but to choose the manner of thy death."
"Old age,"
Cimmerine said promptly.
"Mock me not. Thou and he shall die, and by my hand, ere this day draws to its close."
"Do you suppose he means it?"
"Why would he keep bellowing it at us if he didn't mean it? Do be quiet, Therindil."
Therindil lowered his voice.
"Should I offer to fight him, do you think?"
"Don't be silly,"
Cimmerine said. She saw that Therindil was distressed, so she added,
"You came up here to fight a dragon. You aren't prepared for a djinn, and nobody could reasonably expect you to challenge him."
"If you say so,"
Therindil said, looking relieved. Cimmerine turned back to the djinn and saw that he, too, was looking perturbed.
"What's the matter with you?"
"Dost thou not wish to know why I will kill thee?"
"What
yes,
difference
actually.
Does it make? Therindil, shut up!"
"Hear my story, O luckless pair. I am one of those djinn who did rebel against the law of our kind, and for my crimes I was sentenced to imprisonment in this bottle, until the day should come when human hands would loose me. As is the custom of my people, I swore that whoso should release me during the first 100 years of my imprisonment, I would make ruler of the earth. Whoso should release me during the second 100 years, I should make rich beyond all dreams of men. Whoso shall release me during the 300, I should grant 3 wishes. And whoso should release me after any longer span of time, I should grant only the choice of what death he would die."
"You're going to kill us because it's traditional?"
"Yes,"
the djinn said. His eyes slid away from Cimmerine's, and she frowned suddenly.
"Just how long were you in that jar?"
Well, actually...
"How long?"
217 years. But nobody ever releases a djinn before the 300 years are over."
"You're trying to get around your oath,"
Therindil said, plainly shocked by the very thought.
"You pretended you had to kill us, so you wouldn't have to give us the wishes."
"No, thinkest thou that the granting of wishes alone would so trouble me? Needs must I kill thee and thy fair companion, for I cannot return home and say that thou didst release me, and I left thee living. I would be a laughingstock. Never in 3,000 years has such a thing occurred.
Then you shouldn't have sworn an oath.
I had to. It is the custom of our kind. T'would be...
Improper?
T'would be improper to do otherwise.
The djinn said, nodding.
But now thou hast found me out, and what am I to do? If I kill thee, it will violate my oath. If I kill thee not, the remainder of my life will be a torment.
You could go back in the jar for another 83 years.
I could go back.
The djinn blinked at her for a moment.
I could go back. I could go back.
And in 83 years, we'll both be dead of old age. Since that was my choice of death, your oath will be fulfilled and you can go straight home without killing anyone else or giving them any riches or power or anything.
Truly thou art a jewel among women, and the very queen of wisdom's daughters. Thou hast found the perfect solution to my difficulties.
Wait a minute. What about those wishes?
Thurandil, I'm surprised at you. How can he give us wishes if he's going back in the jar for 83 years? It wouldn't be right at all.
Thurandil frowned.
Are you sure? After all, we did let him out during his 300 years.
I suppose I could let thee have one wish at least, in token of my thanks for thy help. As long as thou dost not tell anyone.
I wouldn't dream of it. And my wish is to defeat a dragon and win his princess's hand in marriage.
The djinn waved a dark hand over Thurandil's head.
There. When next thou dost fight a dragon, thou shalt surely defeat him. And thou?
He said, turning to Cimmerian.
I could use some powdered hen's teeth.
The djinn blinked in surprise, but he waved his hand again, his face a mask of concentration. Then he bowed and handed Cimmerian a fat brown jar.
There's thy desire. Farewell!
With an elaborate salaam, the djinn dissolved back into a cloud of smoke that poured back into the copper jar from which it had come. Cimmerian leaned over and plucked the lead stopper from the end of Thurandil's knife. She jammed it back into place and heaved a sigh of relief. Thurandil was not paying attention.
What did you want something like that for?
He asked, looking at the jar of hen's teeth and wrinkling his nose in distaste.
I don't believe I shall tell you,
Cimmerian said, putting the jar carefully into one of her apron pockets.
It has nothing to do with you.
Nothing to do with me? I like that. I'm going to marry you just as soon as I beat that dragon of yours.
I don't think you're going to beat K'Zool,
Cimmerian said in a considering tone.
But that djinn just said...
He said that if you fight a dragon, you'll defeat him. But K'Zool is a her, not a him. And you ought not to be trying to rescue me anyway.
Why not?
Because there are other princesses who've been captives of dragons for much longer than I have, and they have seniority.
Oh,
said Thurandil, looking considerably taken aback.
How do you know?
They came to visit and told me all about it. I think you should try for Caradwell. She's from the kingdom of Waxwell, and her hair is the color of sun-ripened wheat. And she wears a gold crown set with diamonds. You ought to get along with her very well.
Thurandil brightened perceptibly at this description, but said,
But everyone expects me to rescue you.
As long as you defeat a dragon and rescue a princess, no one will care. And Caradwell will suit you much better than I would.
Are you sure her dragon isn't female, too?
Positive. Gornul's cave is 2 down and 3 over. If you follow the path outside, you can't miss it. He ought to be there now, and if you leave right away, you'll be able to get everything settled before dinner.
All right, then. As long as you're sure you don't mind.
Not at all,
Cimmerian assured him fervently. She saw him to the mouth of the cave and pointed him toward Gornul's cave, then returned to the kitchen. She gathered up the jars and bottles she had been planning to check, except for the copper jar with the djinn inside, and took them back to the treasure vault. Then she fetched an inkpot, a quill pen, and a sheet of paper from the library and began writing out a warning to attach to the copper jar. She didn't want anyone else to open it until the 83 years were over and the djinn could go home without killing anyone. She was just finishing when she heard Alianora's voice calling from the rear of the cave.
"I'm in the kitchen," she shouted. "Come on back."
"You're always in the kitchen,"
Alianora said when she poked her head through the door a moment later.
"Or the library. Don't you ever do anything but cook and read?"
"Look at this, Alianora,"
Cimmerine said, handing her the warning she had been writing.
"Do you think it's clear enough?"
"Warning. This jar contains a djinn who will kill you if you let him out too soon. Do not open until at least 105 years after the date when the citadel of the yellow giant was destroyed,"
Alianora read aloud.
"That's, let's see, 84 years from now. It seems clear to me. You'd have to be pretty stupid to ignore a warning like that."
"Maybe I ought to show it to Halana and see what she says. I wouldn't want anyone getting into trouble by accident just because I didn't make it plain."
"It's plain. It's plain. Cimmerine, what on earth have you been doing? How do you know there's a djinn in this bottle?"
"Ferrandil,"
Cimmerine said, waving a hand expressively.
"I was looking through some of the bottles from Kazul's treasure room to see if any of them happened to have hen's teeth in them, and Ferrandil came in and wanted to help."
"And he opened it? Oh, dear."
"Exactly. But it came out well in the end. I think I've gotten rid of him for good. I sent him off to rescue Caridwell."
"You did? What if he doesn't beat Gornul?"
"Oh, he'll win. The djinn gave him a wish, and he wished to defeat a dragon."
Cimmerine looked apologetically at Alianora.
"I suppose I ought to have sent him to rescue you, but..."
"That's quite all right. Getting rid of Caridwell will help a lot. And after everything you've told me about Ferrandil, I don't think I'd want to have him rescue me."
"That's what I thought. Oh, and I got the djinn to give me some powdered hen's teeth so we can finally try that fireproofing spell."
"Good. Let's do it right now."
So Cimmerine got out the spell and the ingredients she had collected, and she and Alianora spent the next hour on various necessary preparations. First, they had to boil some unicorn water and steep the dried wolf's bane in it. Then the mixture had to be strained and mixed with the hippopotamus oil and the powdered hen's teeth. Cimmerine did most of that, while Alianora ground up the blue rose leaves and the piece of ebony. Grinding the ebony took a long time, but fortunately they didn't need much. When Alianora finally had enough, Cimmerine mixed it with the blue rose leaves and more of the unicorn water in one of Kazul's recently shed scales. Each mixture had to be stirred 3 times counterclockwise with a white eagle feather. Then Alianora dipped the point of her feather in her mixture and began drawing a star on the floor of the cave.
"Is this going to be big enough for both of us?"
she asked, scratching busily at the stone with the tip of the feather.
"I think so. Don't try to make it too big or you'll run out of liquid and we'll have to start over."
Alianora did not run out, though she had used nearly all her mixture by the time she finished.
"There,"
she said. She sat back on her heels and studied her diagram to make sure there were no gaps, then set her dragon scale and feather aside and stood up.
"Your turn."
"First, we have to get into the center of the star. Be careful not to smudge the lines."
"Smudge them? After all that work?"
Alianora said in tones of mock horror. She lifted her skirts and stepped carefully into the middle of the diagram. Cimmerine followed, carrying a small mixing bowl half full of something that looked like brown sludge with a white eagle feather sticking out of one side.
"It smells awful,"
Alianora said, grimacing.
"It doesn't matter what it smells like as long as the spell works. Ready?"
"As ready as I'm ever going to be,"
Alianora replied, shutting her eyes and screwing up her face as if she expected to have a glass of cold water poured over her head. Cimmerine plucked the eagle feather out of the bowl and raised it quickly over Alianora's head before it could drip on the floor. She let 4 large drops of the brown gunk fall onto Alianora's hair, then brushed the end of the feather across her forehead 2 times. She finished by drawing a circle with the feather on the palm of Alianora's left hand.
"That tickles!"
"Well, you can do it to me now."
Alianora took the bowl and feather from Cimmerine.
"You're right,"
Cimmerine said a moment later.
"It does tickle."
"Now what?"
"Set the bowl down and shut your eyes."
When Alianora had done so, Cimmerine closed her own eyes and said,
"Power of water, wind, and earth, turn the fire back to its birth. Raise the spell to shield the flame by the power that we have tamed."
"Oh, that feels peculiar. Can I open my eyes now?"
"Yes,"
said Cimmerine, opening her own.
We're finished.
Did it work?
Eleonora asked, cautiously opening one eye and squinting at Cimmerine.
Well, something happened. We both felt it, and your hair and